Criminal justice is not just a matter of law and order. There are many forces shaping how people end up in jail. Substance abuse, mental health issues, race, and economics all come into play. Recently, we found a man whose story shows us just how interconnected all of these issues are. NHPR's Emily Corwin has the story.
I find Michael Treadwell in the back of a courtroom. He's wearing a windbreaker and work boots and leaning his elbows on his knees. At first, it looks like he's chewing gum. Later, when we talk, I discover he isn't chewing gum, he's chewing his own gums. Michael Treadwell doesn't have teeth.
When you live in a town like Nashua, there's not a lot of homelessness there. And it kind of like focuses on you, it kind of like puts you in the spotlight. Especially if you have alcohol, you drink alcohol and stuff.
Michael is a 53-year-old African-American. I've been looking for him since I came across his criminal record. Over the last 6 years, he's spent 854 days in jail. His charges all basically come from being homeless and getting drunk. Here's his summer of 2015. Trespass in an apartment building, spend 30 days in jail. Bother restaurant customers, 42 days in jail. Panhandle aggressively, 30 days in jail. There are charges for drinking in public and urinating on buildings. This has been Michael's life for years. Drink, get arrested, go to court, go to jail, repeat. At the courthouse, I watch him plead guilty to public urination. Then we take a walk in the rain through the city.
People kill homeless people, violence and everything else. You know, it can be a very dangerous life to live in. You know, I don't suggest jail as an alternative, but no kind of life, you know what I'm saying?
When you were younger, did you think this is what life would be like?
Oh, no. Not at all. Nothing like this. I had different plans, very different plans.
Although Michael did do time for drug charges in the early 90s, for years, his life was on the right track. He traversed the country driving trucks, a job his ex-wife, Sherry Treadwell, tells me he loved. Sitting across from me at her kitchen table, she remembers what a mechanic he was.
He could listen to any motor at all, and he can tell you exactly what the problem is. And if it's not too complicated or need specialized tools, he can fix it for you right there on the spot.
Sherry and Michael got married in 2000 and had two daughters. For the next 10 years, Michael stayed on the right side of the law. To Sherry, all of Michael's problems, the drinking, the homelessness, the stints in jail, they're all symptoms of his mental illness. She tells me a year or two into their marriage, Michael started acting strange.
He would think there's people listening in on our conversations. He would whisper to me in the car, "Shh, the car is bugged." And I'm like, "No, the car is not bugged." He wouldn't talk on the phone. People were following him.
Sherry says Michael turned to alcohol to cope. Concerned for her kids, she told him to leave. They divorced in 2007. Since then, his most serious convictions are two acts of vandalism. But mostly, Michael gets arrested for trespassing. Combined, he spent more than a year and a half in jail for just that. I did the math. According to Hillsborough County, it costs $74 a day to keep someone in jail there. I tell Sherry, since 2011, the county has spent more than $63,000 locking Michael up.
Just on Mike alone?
Yeah, just Mike.
Wow. I didn't know that.
People have tried to help. A year after getting divorced, Michael met Joretta Copeland. He adopted her, unwitting, as a guardian of sorts. He had showed up at her church asking for bus money. 9 years later, Joretta calls looking after Michael a God-given mission. She knows him better than anyone, and she knows how bad he can get when he drinks.
He gets to yelling and screaming and hollering, and he's talking and he's cussing people out, swearing and carrying on, and so forth and whatnot. It scares people because they don't know if he's going to attack them. They don't know what his intentions are.
Joretta says Michael needs to go somewhere that can help him with both the alcoholism and the voices in his head. Really, she says he needed this decades ago. She's tried to get him into the state mental hospital. 3 years ago, the perfect opportunity arrived. Michael was in jail for trespassing again. This time, a judge began the process to get him committed.
Let's see. Wow.
Jaretta shuffles through the folders of Michael's jail and medical records. She finds it.
Okay. Petition and Certificate for Involuntary Emergency Admission, IEA. Michael Treadwell, July 29, 2014.
The jail had Michael ready to go. The hospital had a psychiatrist ready. But the sheriff didn't get the memo. He was supposed to take Michael from jail to the hospital.
By the time everything connected, the timing was too late. The psychiatrist had left.
Jaretta says the jail would not coordinate another visit. Instead, 3 years later, Michael continues to cycle from the streets to court to jail and back again.
The system isn't working at all for people like Mike.
Sherry, Michael's ex-wife, says Mike's not the only one who the system has failed. Her daughters don't have a dad around. She works two jobs and is rarely home, and they miss him. At one point, Sherry tells me if Michael gets on the straight and narrow, she'll marry him again. But then she tells me this.
His liver is gone now because of the alcoholism, and so we know he's not going to be around for too much longer. And this hurts. This hurts the girls and I, and it hurts me more because I know the system could have done something. Had he had some kind of money or clout or whatever it takes, he could have gotten that help that he needed.
Last time I talked to Michael, he told me he wanted to go down to South Carolina, where he grew up, to get his trucking license back in order. I recently checked in with Sherry. She told me he had gotten down to South Carolina. He called her from a jail down there. For NHPR, I'm Emily Corwin.
The New Hampshire Parole Board plays a key role in the state's criminal justice system. Its 9 members decide which inmates get out on parole and which parolees return to prison. Although parole hearings are open to the public, they take place with little oversight or public scrutiny. And unlike most legal proceedings, they can be surprisingly unrefined affairs. NHPR's Emily Corwin reports, and just a warning for our listeners, this story contains some crude language.
It's all brick and pavement outside the prison. I'm standing at a sort of side entrance. There are 3 locked doors between me and the place I'm going. This building used to be the warden's residence. There's a room upstairs where 3 parole board members sit 5 hours a day, twice a week. Donna Sitek chairs the board.
It is probably the cleanest building in the state because the only place I've ever been where they empty the waste baskets twice a day because they have all this free labor.
She's talking about inmates. Inside, hearings take place in what looks like a courtroom. Parole board members sit behind a wooden bench. Often, new lawyers stand up to address the board. They're told to sit down. This is not a courtroom. It often doesn't sound like one, either.
I know I shouldn't be chewing your ass like this, but you know damn well what I'm talking about. You know
that's parole board member Jeff Brown during a hearing in February. A month earlier, the colorful Leslie Mendenhall, another board member.
Well, the thing about a good car salesman is they know how to blow smoke up your ass by smiling to your face and telling you absolutely lies.
NHPR reviewed 20 hours of parole hearings from the last year. These are the voices of public officials tasked with making decisions about people's liberty and community safety. Where we expected civility, we found foul language and confrontation.
Well, there is a perception that the parole board is sort of like the Wild West. The rules are loosely applied.
David Hendricks spent hundreds of hours in parole hearings as a public defender. He says lawyers take things for granted in a courtroom that go by the wayside here. Like in court, hearsay and unsworn testimony are not valid. At a parole hearing, these are seemingly fair game. Decorum, he says, can also go out the window.
Transferring to extension 102.
Many hearings take place by video conference. The board has about 15 minutes to decide if people convicted of sex offenses, drug crimes, domestic violence can live safely outside prison walls. They do this with no training or prerequisite experience. Inmates who meet the minimum requirements are almost always granted parole. I was at a hearing a few months back when Adam Smart got paroled. His mother sat next to me at the back of the room. He told the board he's struggled with addiction. He said he didn't get as much drug treatment as he would have liked behind bars. He said he's been on a waiting list for treatment in the community. And he said his counselor wasn't very helpful. At some point as he spoke, board member Leslie Mendenhall decided he was making excuses.
I think you're full of shit, and I think you're just trying to sell a nice boat down the river. You're full of it. Full of yourself.
It's all on record, right? Every time I've gone to mental health.
Every single time.
Okay. So you can
and
see
what are you taking for medications?
Nothing.
Nothing?
No.
Why?
Because they want to put me on sleep meds for anxiety.
Right, because do you know one of the best things you can do for bipolar is to make sure that you get a solid amount of sleep, because that helps stable your mood?
I don't know if I have bipolar.
You're sure presenting like a bipolar.
It strikes me as completely inappropriate. It's certainly not the parole board's role to advise them on their mental health issues.
I met Phil Utter at another parole hearing. He's a private defense attorney. I played the exchange back for him.
And swearing at an inmate? How can that possibly be helpful? This is a person who's going to be reintegrating into society at some point, and if you start belittling them, it's just wrong. It's just wrong.
David Hendricks, the attorney who called the board the Wild West, went into more detail.
You know, their job is to demonstrate conduct that takes seriously laws, takes seriously the principles of what their job is.
He says he fears when a government official denigrates someone, they can lose faith in the entire system and become less likely to abide by laws. Mendenhall chose not to be interviewed for the story. The board's chair, Donna Sitek, says things used to be even more informal.
That's one of the reasons I asked to be appointed to the parole board. I didn't think the hearings were accorded the dignity that the parties and the process deserve.
Sitek is a former New Hampshire House Speaker who published a guide to political etiquette. She calls Mendenhall's exchange inappropriate. Still, she says confrontation can be constructive for some inmates. Another board member, Brian Cashman, defended the tough talk. He said it's important to let inmates know insincerity won't be tolerated.
If you're going to get their attention, you have to get their attention.
And Cashman said feeling deceived by an inmate can make you emotional.
I try not to, but sometimes it just comes out.
Attorney David Hendricks says he knows how frustrating the job is, and he knows just how fraught the justice system can be. But being polite?
That is something that is not very difficult to achieve and is sort of a bare minimum that we should just frankly expect.
For NHPR News, I'm Emily Corwin.
A refugee from the Congo is out on bail after spending 3 weeks in a New Hampshire jail. She faces charges of child abuse. The state says she's a danger to her community. Many in that community disagree. NHPR's Emily Corwin reports how cultural misunderstanding and language barriers can challenge the state's criminal justice system.
9 months ago, Joyce Chance arrived in Concord, New Hampshire. She's 32 and she has two kids. In March, the state of New Hampshire took Chance's kids away. First, they were placed with relatives, later in foster care. The kids' teachers had rung the alarm. They suspected child abuse. A month later, police arrested Joyce Chance.
She is charged with disciplining her children by hitting them, allegedly with a broom stick.
This is Robin Davis, Chance's defense attorney. The state charged Chance with 5 counts of assault against her children. She spent that night in jail. The next day, a judge concluded Chance was both at risk of fleeing and a danger to her community. She would spend the next 3 weeks behind bars.
The big issue here is the cultural differences.
People who know Joyce Chance say she should not have been arrested and never belonged in jail. Samuel Bahuma also came from Congo as a refugee. He arrived here more than a decade ago and calls himself a community leader. He knows Chance.
Do you think that she's a danger to the public?
No. No. She's not a danger to the public. She needs help.
Bahuma and Chance's attorney say miscommunication and misunderstanding have shaped Chance's time in the criminal justice system. First, there's the language problem. Chance doesn't speak English. Bahuma says it's easy for law enforcement to assume guilt when they can't understand someone.
I cannot say that the police are bad. I'm not saying because the police, they come according to the information they have.
It's not just language. The information Bahuma says police and the courts really need is about her life.
She's traumatized for so long time.
These last 9 months are the first time Joyce Chance hasn't been subject to war and violence in her life. She was born 32 years ago in a village in Congo. Bahuma says life in Congo has been brutal, especially for women.
Most of women, and they have experience of rape, by either military or the police. And it's not a rape one time. It is like a cycle. In 1 year, you will go through 4-5 situations, and you can't control it because the police, they have gun, they have everything. You don't have anything.
About 400 refugees are resettled in New Hampshire every year. In Concord, many are born in Central Africa and come from war. As Davis, Chance's attorney, says, both the justice system and the refugees themselves need more information about each other.
You know, I think that there is a gap here that needs to be filled. I'm not sure by who, but, you know, I think we're doing more harm than good to the refugees.
The court's lack of information about refugees was conspicuous at Joyce Chance's initial bail hearing.
Because I have no understanding of her status in this community. I have no idea what the refugee community from Congo, how it exists in this state as in others.
That was part of the reasoning Judge Diane Nicolosi gave when she set Chance's bail, putting her behind bars. The facts were available at the time. A refugee caseworker assigned to assist Chance was in the courtroom. She likely could have explained that refugees in the United States have rigorous identity and background screenings. She also knew that Chance's family lives in the same apartment complex, that Chance goes to church, takes English classes, and has a community. That caseworker was not asked to speak during the bail hearing. Then Judge Nicolosi alluded to one more accusation against Chance. This one was about her kids. It's something Chance's attorney describes as hurtful.
There is some indication that there may not be a biological connection.
Police discovered Chance's children speak a language she doesn't speak. Now they question if the kids are her own. Bahuma, the Congolese community leader, actually laughed when I asked him about it.
I think the kid belonged to her.
He says her kids grew up in a refugee camp in Uganda. Their teachers spoke a different language than Chance would have learned in Congo. A DNA test could settle things. That hasn't happened yet. In the meantime, the police alerted Homeland Security, who may be investigating Chance for visa fraud. That agency wouldn't confirm the investigation, but the prospect of federal charges bolstered the state's argument that Chance may flee. After that hearing, Chance's attorney, Robin Davis, quickly requested a second bail hearing. It wouldn't get on the court's docket for another 3 weeks. As Chance waited in jail, Davis fretted.
They don't have interpreters at the jail, so she doesn't have the ability to ask for the simple things like a glass of water or advise them whether or not she's having any health issues or she has any questions. Many times she will not be complying with what's asked of her, like head count or things of that nature, because she doesn't understand.
When that second hearing finally arrived, Judge Nicolosi was at the bench again. Chance sat in an orange jumpsuit, her ankles shackled. This time, a few things were different. Chance's supporters filled two rows of benches. Her pastor was there. And Chance's attorney came armed with information about refugees. Judge Nicolosi let Chance go home. A week later, I sat on a couch in Chance's apartment in Concord. It was late May. Chance sat across from me in a colorful patterned dress and a black winter hat. She stared down at the couch and wiped occasionally at her eye. We talked through a translator.
So where I came from, if your children does something wrong, we're able to punish them. But when I get here, I punished my children, and nobody told me that it's not okay to punish your children that way.
To clarify, in New Hampshire, a guardian can use physical force against a minor when she reasonably believes it's necessary. The state will likely argue Chance's behavior was reckless and caused substantial pain, making it illegal. A trial date hasn't been set yet. When it is, the stakes will be high. A felony conviction could mean deportation. For NHPR News, I'm Emily Corwin.
On any given day in Manchester's Valley Street Jail, several dozen people are being held on bail of $1,000 or less. Most are charged with low-level offenses and would be back at home if they could pay their bail. That's according to NHPR's analysis of data provided by the jail. NHPR's Emily Corwin reports on New Hampshire's money bail system, a process some courts in other states have abandoned.
The day I met Chris Weber, he was wearing a beige jumpsuit in the jail library, studying for his GED. Last year, the 19-year-old spent a total of 2 months behind these bars. His record includes 2 convictions, one for trespassing, the other for resisting arrest. But that's not why he was locked up. He was locked up because he's missed court dates. That, and he's poor. When I met him, Weber was being held on $500 cash bail for the month leading up to his rescheduled hearing.
And why can't you pay the $500?
I have a daughter, so like priorities are like formula, diapers, and wipes, not me getting out.
New Hampshire's judges are supposed to let you go home while you wait for hearings and trials, except in 2 circumstances. One, if the judge thinks you're a threat to public safety. Or 2, if they think you might not show up for court. That's where money bail comes in. Requiring bail, especially relatively low bail, allows people in Category 2, the flight risks, a way to go home. You put down a deposit and you have an incentive to come back for court. But what if the judge sets a bail you can't afford?
Sorry.
It's okay.
This is Weber's 4-month-old baby girl and her mom, Catherine Sprints.
You're okay.
If they had the money, Sprint says, Weber would be home. Instead, he's spent weeks behind bars.
Like he missed her birth. She's gonna know when she's older that her dad wasn't there.
According to an NHPR analysis of jail data spanning 2 years, 62 or so people are held at Valley Street Jail each day because they can't afford bail of $1,000 or less. More than half of these are charged only with nonviolent offenses like drug possession, trespass, and resisting arrest. Chief Justice Tina Netto oversees the state's felony-level courts. She's seen a lot of people who miss court dates, people like Chris Weber.
When people don't show up for court, it's usually because they forgot, or they've moved, or they lost their transportation, you know, those kinds of things. They aren't generally trying to skip town because they want to avoid process.
Being in jail has documented consequences. It can lead to job loss and eviction. Research shows doing time makes people more likely to commit other crimes. And for those held pre-trial, jail also increases the likelihood a defendant will be found guilty of a crime, will plead to a charge, and will be sentenced to time behind bars. And yet, Judge Netto says, money bail is the only system most New Hampshire judges have to make sure even low-level defendants appear.
We're using a lot of resources, continuing hearings, having witnesses and folks come back to court because the offender's not appearing.
Other places are trying to help defendants show up for court. In New York City, defendants now receive text message and phone call reminders about court summons, so it's harder to forget. One court implemented evening hours for people with jobs. Some states have made more fundamental changes. The District of Columbia eliminated money bail altogether. New Mexico and New Jersey have recently overhauled their bail systems, too. So what's the holdup in New Hampshire?
There is a real interest, I think, in finding a solution to this issue.
Devin Chafee heads up the New Hampshire ACLU, which is part of the state's Interbranch Justice Council. That group has identified bail reform as a priority. Yet some of the tools used to replace money bail have had mixed results. That's why Chafee says the first step is figuring out who is being held on bail now and why.
Because if New Hampshire's really going to consider bail reform seriously, then we need to have a sense of what the baseline is so we can evaluate the impact of any reform measures that are adopted.
This has not been easy. Last year, the New Hampshire Department of Justice got federal funding to hire a nonprofit to get all that data. But inconsistent jail software meant the study only covered part of the state. How to proceed now is still unclear. In the meantime, people like Chris Weber are waiting behind bars. For NHPR News, I'm Emily Corwin.